The following program is a repeat. I trust you enjoy it.
And they recommend that glyphosate-based herbicides be taken out of public places, POEA be banned in all the member countries, and a reduction in the amount that's being used as a desiccant, which means being sprayed on crops ahead of harvest so that the grain or whatever would ripen more evenly for the harvester, so they wouldn't have to be drying it out when they get damp patches in the paddock and riper patches elsewhere. So POEA is meant to be out over there, and they were drawing it flat out and they're using other adjuvants. Now, some of those may be equally as toxic.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Today, we as a humanity are in the birth canal of a major evolutionary paradigm shift. Never have we witnessed such tumultuous change as we are experiencing as of now, with the converging of four major waves of ecology, economy, societal distress, and war that are starting to peak like never before. We, 7.5 billion souls, the salt of humanity, are at the crossroads. But more so, the whole biosphere that we are embedded in is at stake. We have to come together in unity consciousness as a global family and sort out our differences, knowing that we all share the same breath, that service to self is not an option. We need to be mindful and cooperate and work together for the betterment of life and the benefit of the whole, especially for all children. And at a deeper level, latter-day science, though reluctant and with teeth gritted, is recognizing that our planet is a vast, colossal superorganism that lends us humans bodies in which to live. Yes, that is correct. We are an evolutionary extension to the degree that we are composed of minerals, water, and air, just like our great sustainer. This concept is so large that many are unable to grasp the ramifications of awakening to our conscious connection. Yet the indigenous peoples of our planet intuitively get it and are now saying, hey, white man, guess what we've been telling you for many hundreds of years. And this shift is taking place, being it the rights of nature that Bolivia and Ecuador are now acknowledging and enacting into law, and to the Aotearoa Māori in New Zealand, who over the last few years have had the government recognise the 2,000 square kilometre parkland Te Uruwera as a legal entity having human rights, and a large river system, the Whanganui, with 7,000 square kilometres of catchment area as a living entity with legal status. What this is signifying is that consciousness of humanity is rising to realise that we are an extension of a greater reality, and people are recognising the sacredness of the land and the waters, and that within the membrane of the atmospheric envelope, we are one planet and one people. And to bring this into being, all it may need is a change of heart. On the phone from Blenheim in South Island, I have Stephen Browning. He's a Green Party Member of Parliament as he finishes his final term after 6 years, and he's deciding now on a new life outside the restrictive environment we have in Wellington. I want to say kia ora. Thank you for coming and wanting to share with New Zealanders at this important moment, Stephen.
Thanks very much, Tim. As always, it's great to be connecting with you, and I really appreciate the work that you do.
Yes, well, it's an interesting world that we've got ourselves into now, Stephen, because you are living just up the road in Blenheim from Waihopai, the Five Eyes Echelon satellite station that essentially vacuums every email, every text, every telephone call or fax or anything that's electronic, and they all end up in Maryland, in the United States, and or it could be actually in Utah, a gigantic data center codenamed Bumble Hive. That's where it collects all the data on human beings. But, Stefan, I want to go beyond that just in the meantime, because you've done some fantastic things in Parliament and you've really been a wonderful advocate for a green today and a green tomorrow, particularly in the way of organics, keeping fish farming honest, and also making sure that GE and GMOs don't get sneakily introduced to our country, which vested interests are endeavouring to do. What is on the agenda at the moment? Because you're just pushing a bill through Parliament, aren't you?
Yeah, so my last main projects, but seriously every day, different things come to me where people want support. Meat inspectors meeting me, I think, this week. The beekeepers meeting me this week. There's the biosecurity breaches, 1, 2, 3, that I'm working on. Sometimes people don't see it, but I'm working in the background at least, trying to get as quick correction to these incursions as possible. But the main two projects that are really resting on me is one around glyphosate, the principal ingredient in Roundup-type herbicides. Another one is the bill that I've got in Parliament, is the Country of Origin of Food Labelling Bill. It's got a different name. It's Consumers' Right to Choice Country of Origin Labelling Bill. And I was very, very lucky to draw that as a member's bill. I was very fortunate. Sue Kedgley, a predecessor of mine, in fact, I'm sitting in exactly the same chair as Sue did in exactly the same office that she sat in for a number of years. She moved out, I moved in effectively 6 years ago, and she had run a petition around country of origin labelling that nearly everybody wants. She had, I think, something like 37,000 signatures in 2007. I modified the bill that she had drafted back then, and it's been very interesting to see the progression of political acceptance or interest or acknowledgement of the consumer's huge desire to have country of origin labelling. And I used to, when I was the Soil and Health Association, the publishers of Organic NZ magazine, I used to do advocacy the same time that Sue was doing that to Annette King, who was the Minister for the Labour government at the time. And they were pushing back, saying, not doing it. And then ultimately, I can't remember if it was last election or the one before, Labour joined in saying we needed a level of country of origin labelling. So they were grabbing some greenie points. And now we've got National doing it as well. So for the first reading of my bill, there was only one Member of Parliament opposed to it, and that was David Seymour from ACT, who told me, when I said to him, why wouldn't you do that? It's for consumer choice. You're a libertarian party. And he said, I want to stay to the right of National. And so for that pathetic reason, we had one Member of Parliament that did not support country of origin labelling at the first reading. So we've now been, and we are now presently going through select committee stages. We've had the submissions and some very interesting ones too. So we're probably changing the format of how it will be introduced, and departmental officials will come back to us in about a week and a half, Thursday week, and we'll look at some options of how we might best make it, because the bill was good, but it'll probably be better fitted under the Fair Trading Act. And I'm hoping that we get it as advanced as much as possible through the parliamentary process before I'm out of there. There's only a limited number of parliamentary weeks before the House rises, 6 weeks ahead of the election. So it probably won't get all the way through, and there might be a small miracle and some interesting support that might help that happen, but it does have to go through some due process. Whether we can fast-track the last couple of readings, I don't know. But if not, there'll be another Member of Parliament will put their name to it, and in the new Parliament, no matter what the government looks like, that should be able to be finished then.
Yes, well, look, fantastic. I really applaud you, because we've been waiting for it so long. I mean, Australia's got it, the Europeans have got it, and we see how the pushback has been, particularly in the United States, when it comes to if there's any GE components inside this food. So I want to say thank you once again, Stefan.
On that, Tim, in fact, I won't sit on the subject for too long, but sometimes you think, really, the universe does provide serendipity and all that sort of thing.
You bet.
We've got another bill in front of Parliament at the moment. It's not ours, it's a government bill, Food Safety Law Reform Bill, and it was all around that botulism scare and the need to make sure there was good processes of record keeping if there was need to be food recalls and things like that. So when we were working through that bill in Select Committee, I was trying to get country of origin labelling in there through an amendment to that bill. We were told that that couldn't happen because it just was outside the scope of the bill, and probably fair comment. But as nothing ventured, nothing gained, and that's the sort of thing I would always be pushing. So right at the very moment when the chair of our committee was saying, look, remember the clerk said that it's outside the scope. No, you can't put that in there. We're just looking at our final select committee report. And then Richard Prost from New Zealand First gave me a nudge, and he'd been looking at his emails, and the ballot had been drawn, and my bill for country origin labelling got drawn right at the minute that I couldn't be getting as an amendment to the other bill. Now, the other bill, Food Safety Law Reform Bill, something that was in scope, and I'm putting it up as an amendment. Whether it will be voted in support, I don't know. I'm going to the minister to try and get his support for it. It's David Bennett, the new Food Safety Minister. And that is to get the labelling of genetically engineered and irradiated foods actually monitored and enforced as intended. Genetically engineered foods, most of them, not all, there's a couple of exemptions, most of them are meant to be being labelled on our shelves, but they have not been monitored or enforced, that labelling, since 2003. And I would ask your listeners to let you know, or me know, or me through you, if they can find anything on the shelves that says genetically modified in there. You will see some modified starches. That's not necessarily genetically modified. That's highly refined maize starches or this or that, not necessarily genetically modified, but something that actually says it's genetically modified. I'm aware of a couple of products only, and we know that there's loads of genetically modified soy, genetically engineered, same thing, coming into New Zealand, a lot of it for animal feed, but some of that's going into our bread, some of it was going to, some, no doubt, some tofus and things like that. So that should be, if it's known that it's genetically modified, it should be being labelled, and it's not been. So I've got an amendment in there. I'll be meeting with the minister and trying to get cross-party support for my amendment, which all it says is that they must monitor effectively or regularly and effectively for that labelling to make sure it's happening. The legislation, the regulation is there, but I'm just putting that extra little lever in there to make the chief executive, before Ministry for Primary Industries, do the job as they're meant to be doing.
Okay, Stephen, yes, well, irradiation of food, there's a little place up just north of Brisbane where all this, the Australian food is irradiated, and we've got to be really on the ball on this one. It's okay for us older generation. I mean, we're already semi sort of polluted, but with children and babies, having irradiated food is just a not on situation for them, and we've got to keep on top of that. So thank you for that. And tell me, with regard to other things, can you quickly give us 5 minutes on what's happening on the fish, how many fish farming farms there are in Marlborough? Are they adhering to what I would call mindfulness in the way they're taking care of the ecology?
No, they're not. I mean, sometimes there seems to be some improvements, but not really. I still own land in the outer Marlborough Sounds, the only piece of terra firma that I've got a name to in New Zealand. And out there in the 90s, I was aware of the increase in marine farming and was thinking, just a sec, where is this going to go? Are we going to be left with some open space, some coastline that won't have aquaculture? And I got involved back then and ran an Environment Court case against an application that I was successful in, just on basically landscape, seascape, the beauty, the experience of being in a natural space without industry there. And that helped with the formation of the Marlborough Sounds Resource Management Plan that said where marine farming could extend to, it did allow for further extension, and where it could be maybe subject to some extra issues, but non-complying with the status, and then there was areas that were outright prohibited. Unfortunately, New Zealand King Salmon, who was a signatory to that plan, to any of the appeals, that never went through to a full court thing. They were assigned through mediation. They signed off in agreement to that. They come back later wanting to expand into those areas. There were some major court cases and hearings and stuff, and they got a couple through a plan change mechanism. Then they've come back now saying, look, some of the farms we already had, they're not performing well, and I will just use the bad language, they're shitting in their own nests because of their own pollution that's causing disease and production problems there, because they've got far too many. It's like intensive dairy. They just have far too many fish in the one space. They want to shift those out to areas that have got higher flushing, you know, more tidal flow, cooler waters as well. And again, they're trying to go into the areas that they'd agreed would be prohibited at one stage. So there's been a new hearing for these relocations, as they call them, but it's actually expansion, because it's not to stop anyone using the old spaces if they can, when the poisoning slows down. That hearing panel included the lawyer for the marine farming industry that I beat in 96, 97. And he's on the hearings panel listening to this. So I actually just pointed out the similarities between the cases of going into new areas. The Marlborough Sounds is not growing. The Marlborough Sounds is the same area, but industry keeps on pushing, and ultimately they've come back in another few years, a bit more and a bit more and a bit more. So I've been always pushing for independent science. It needs to be independent. There's some very good science being done, but it's really about production. It comes from NIWA or Cawthron Institute, looking at what's happening on the bottom under the marine, under them, and thinking how much can they, crap can they have falling down there before it's too polluted and won't digest properly with the organisms that live in the marine area. And if they just buttoned off, had less fish, they might be able to do it. But they just keep pushing. And that's the fish. The mussels, there still lacks independent science on what their filtration of the bottom of the food web does. So I have been around the edges of that still, not the same as when I was super active before I went into Parliament. The issue's still there. I support the groups that have been trying to get the right balance. I do eat mussels. I make a point of eating mussels to show that I'm not against the industry, but it's a matter of where the balance is. I will not eat New Zealand King Salmon because of just how atrocious that company has been, in my view, and a continual push for unsustainable system in the Marlborough Sounds.
Now, this fish, is it in most of the major supermarkets in New Zealand? Because I did buy some salmon the other day just to taste it, and it sort of nearly broke up in my hands. It didn't have any real texture. Is this the usual salmon that's factory?
Yeah, there's a range of companies, and New Zealand King Salmon has a range of brands. I probably shouldn't be going too much down the track of those. In particular, salmon is an interesting thing. They say we need an aquaculture because the wild fishery is so stuffed. 50% of the world's fish consumed is from fish farms, a lot of it from ponds and that through Asia and the likes. But the actual getting the feed together, which is a mixture of some wild fish, particularly anchovy off the South American coast, other fish waste, but also waste from our freezing works. They bring in more and more vegetable protein because it's cheaper, and that changes the omega-3, omega-6 makeup of the fish. It's not even nutritionally as good as they suggest it is. So that can be salmon from anywhere that's farmed. But if I was to eat salmon, I would look at some of the other South Island companies before I would look at that particular company, because of my personal experience with them in the Marlborough Sounds. The huge anxiety, the angst, the huge personal cost to people in the NGO world and Sounds residents, as they're trying to get even a bit of democracy around the decision-making on that. So it's an unsustainable fishery. If anything, if the wild fishery is kaput, as it effectively is, we should be building and restoring the wild fishery rather than saying, oh, well, it's stuffed now. Let's move on to the next unsustainable practice, which is some of the intensive fish farming.
Okay, yes, well, boy, well, everybody's antennae needs to go up there. We have to be really, really aware of what's happening. Essentially, big government is not looking at the future of our children. There's no long-term thinking. There's no real strong sustainability. It's just, again, is to extract as much out of a situation, isn't it?
Yeah, quick profits before sustainability.
Okay, now organics. Organics is both yours and mine. This is one of our major, this makes me all warm and fuzzy when I get into my garden and see just what just comes out of the ground so fast. It's just so fresh and vital. There was a thing called Organics 2020 that Brendan Howery was really pushing, and I'm still with him. Where do you think we can go with organics, bearing in mind that organic farmers can get near on twice the value, financial value from their product when they sell it on the overseas markets, and yet here in New Zealand, it's still struggling, even though we're having about a 10 or 11% increase every year. We need a bigger jump, don't we?
Yes, well, the thing that we really need, of course, is to have a government pick up the idea of organic target. I was very, very fortunate, and my role allowed me to do that, to go to Denmark part of last winter, which was their summer, and because they were a country with very clear organic targets. Particularly right when government came in and took the target away, but the momentum's so strong that they'll meet their target, and I think it's going to be 15% organic by 2020. They're on a real roll. You see organics all over the place. They have this thing called Organic Kitchen, so the government's got it. Purchasing arrangements that ensure that organics is going into any government-type or council-type kitchen facility. There's restaurants are all marking up to their percentage of organics, and they have pesticide reduction strategies as well. And I also met officials in The Hague and the Netherlands, and they have some fairly good initiatives too, as does Germany. You know, some of these countries are still using some of the pesticides and stuff, unfortunately, to levels that might be more than we would expect. But they actually have constructive programs to develop organics more in their countries, and they really see the value. In Denmark, it was really pronounced. I believe Austria is similar, and some other countries. Here in New Zealand, we have got some good news stories, and I've come directly from the opening of the Organic and Biodynamic Wine Conference 2017 in Blenheim, my hometown, and 100 wineries there. I think it might be 15 of them from Australia, but 100 wineries represented there today, and let's say there's at least 80 New Zealand wine companies, some level of organics at the moment. They were aiming for 20% by 2020. They're not going to get there, but it's not that they're not still growing. It's just unfortunate that there's such a growth in non-organic viticulture still that's sort of diluting the progress of the organic sector. But Villa Maria, I was on some of their vineyards, and they're in Marlborough, but they're also in Hawke's Bay, where Brendan Howery with Organics Aotearoa New Zealand, the Organics Umbrella Group, had some of us from the select committee up there, and we were on a Villa Maria vineyard, and Jonathan, guy in charge there, who's down at this conference in Blenheim today, but he was saying that Villa Maria, which is a big New Zealand family-owned business, is going to be 50% organic by 2020. So there's some really good news stories. There's some pure organic vineyards in Marlborough, great names from Saracens, Tufari Ra, All Pioneers, Cheriton, and there's numerous others, obviously, and some with organic and expanding their percentage of organics as they go. So that's a very good news story. The so-called sustainable wine growing, and I'll give that a slap, good that there is the so-called sustainable wine growing, which is effectively all wine growers in New Zealand that are. And they have certain standards they're meant to meet, but they're a low bar target. But they do, one good thing is they've got integrated pest management. So instead of spraying willy-nilly every 2 weeks, they do actually monitor and see the need for spraying before they do. But in 2007, and I think it was the same last year, when I looked, 2007 I measured more definitively, there was 70% of the Marlborough viticulture area, surface area, including just inside the gates, the headlands, not just under the vines and between the vines, but 70% of that surface area was herbicided in spring as they struggled to try and get another 1 or 1.5 degrees frost protection by having bare ground warming up in the sun, and that would emanate at night and just reduce the frost. But now the organic guys don't do that, and they succeed just as well. So that's an outrageous level of glyphosate. They've now got glyphosate-resistant ryegrass because they were spraying it so regularly here. So sustainable wine growing is not what it says it is. Its direction, it's just great, and I applaud them for the direction, and they are lifting the bar within it, but it's still so much voluntary. So the organics and biodynamics are the illustrations and the videos used to promote sustainable wine growing. I will guarantee you that 90% of that PR material is from organic and biodynamic vineyards. And Viticulture New Zealand, the Wine Growing New Zealand, is actually behind it, which is good. Quite often in a sector, let's say sheep and beef or pip fruit or something like that, you won't get the sector being so strongly in support of the organic component. But in wine growing, as much as they've got the pseudo-sustainable, they are actually in behind the organic sector. And today in the Marlborough's ASB Theatre conference facility, there was a very well-packed audience, and my old school classmate, the Mayor John Leggett, opened it today, but it was just so normalised, the organics and the viticulture. So anyway, I'm blowing on a lot about that. There's good growth in the horticulture section and pip fruit and kiwi fruit. The dairy is getting away, and that's where that huge price differential that you talked about before is. Fonterra's last recorded known public price for farm gate milk was over $9 per kilo of milk solids. People are cheering because the non-organic has crept up to the $6 area again after being down around $4 and maybe threatening to go less. There's great opportunity, but our minister and successive ministers have not grabbed that opportunity and gotten behind. So market forces will rule rather than getting in behind, as the government really, really needs to do. One positive thing at Parliament is that 2014 or thereabouts, 2015, I was trying to get the organic market report that Brendan and Owens had got together to launch that at Parliament. And I could not get cross-party support. Damien O'Connor for Labor came in for a bit, which was great, but I couldn't get the minister to do it. I couldn't get the select committee to do it. And the next time that came round last year, and my office organised it and ran it that time. But because I think of the dairy price and the acknowledgement that there's some serious money there, I have to applaud Ian McKelvey, the National Party select committee chairperson for the primary production select committee, grabbed that market report, and the select committee sponsored it, and it was very well supported at that parliamentary level. And so there's a recognition that there is actually a place for it. And Ian was up at the Hill Days in the Hawke's Bay a couple of weeks ago looking at the organic chicken, organic pip fruit, organic vegetables, Scott Lawson's vegetable production place, and then also, as I say, Villa Maria as showcases of the bigger money. But one thing we must have in this country is a regulation around the word organic. There's nothing to stop almost anybody calling almost anything organic. And if they say it's certified organic and it's not, that you can get them taken to court. Very hard to without proper regulation of the term organic. That will happen. I can see the cross-party members getting it now after lots of lobbying and stuff being put in front of them, the minister coming and going on it. But it looks like that will... They know they need to do that just so they can maintain access to export markets. But we must make sure that the grassroots person, the dear Margaret Jones, who's passed away,
yes,
the people like her could call their stuff organic and be covered by the new regulation when it comes. So I'll be looking out for that even when I'm outside Parliament.
One of the things, Stephen, last year in the European Parliament, 41 different green European MPs were tested for glyphosate from about 13 different countries, and every single one of them had glyphosate in their urine, and it was really, really bad. It was three or four, five times the European's allowable standard. Were you aware of that?
Yes, I did see that, and I haven't got round to doing the same thing here, and I don't particularly need to know that we can expect to have a similar outcome in New Zealand. So I've been working very hard around the glyphosate issue. There's other loads of other pesticides that deserve very strong attention too, but it's very, very representative of what's happening around pesticides and how our regulatory bodies administer risk analysis, and then obviously the regulations of use. and where it should go and not go. And so I had a spray-free streets and park campaign. We're in the regulated period at the moment, so I can't push that material out with the parliamentary crest as such at the moment, but I'm still working on the issue as a live issue. So glyphosate-based herbicides, because it's not just the glyphosate, it's the surfactants and formulants that are part of each product.
Excuse me, that's important. Really, can you spell that out? Because glyphosate itself seems to be a red herring, and everybody jumps on glyphosate, but it's the adjutants. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so, I mean, glyphosate was declared to be a probable carcinogen by IARC, the International Agency for Research in Cancer, and they were definitely right. It is a carcinogen in my view, but they're very, very conservative and cautionary about the statements they make. They come out and said it was a probable carcinogen. So that was glyphosate, the principal ingredient. But the adjuvants, as they call them, the stickers and spreaders and the emulsifiers and bits and pieces that go into a formulant. You never go to Bunnings or Mitre 10 and buy glyphosate. You buy a glyphosate-based herbicide. So for that to work, there's stuff in there that will penetrate, they call the waxy cuticle, the skin of a leaf, and to let that get into the plant properly. There's others that will make the spray spread evenly, and there's a range of different compounds that go into a full formulation and then come out with a brand name like Roundup, for example, and there are others. There are 91 glyphosate-based herbicide products registered in New Zealand, and from Official Information Act material I've got, I realise that that might only make up 80% of the actual number of glyphosate-based products in New Zealand. So there could be over 100 different products. Some of them might not be being sold at the moment, but as I say, there's 91 registered. 75% of those, I think it's 69, have a thing in there called, and I'll try and get the pronunciation right, polyethoxylated telloamine. P-O-E-A is the way to call it, P-O-E-A in capitals. In Europe, that's effectively banned. What came along after that IARC finding and then further information was that P-O-E-A as one of the adjuvants was so highly toxic in its own regard, let alone in the mixture of a formulation with glyphosate. And they recommended that glyphosate-based herbicides be taken out of public places, POEA be banned in all the member countries, and a reduction in the amount that's being used as a desiccant, which means being sprayed on crops ahead of harvest so that the grain or whatever would ripen more evenly for the harvester, so they wouldn't have to be drying it out when they get damp patches in the paddock and riper patches elsewhere. So POEA is meant to be out over there. And they were drawing it flat out and using other adjuvants. Now, some of those may be equally as toxic. But anyway, in New Zealand, I said, well, tell me which ones of the glyphosate-based herbicides have POEA in them. And Nick Smith, the minister, said he is told by his officials that they can't tell us for commercial sensitivity. You and me as a consumer, even if we wanted to use the stuff, couldn't choose a product without POEA because we wouldn't know which one. And 75% of them have it, of the known products. So it's crude and rude here. And this EPA we have, Environmental Protection Authority, read Economic Protection Authority.
Correct.
They set a retired toxicologist up, commissioned them to pull apart the IARC finding a probable carcinogen for strengths and weaknesses in it, and then come back. Now, I've no doubt they had an end point of wanting that ruling not to hold because of ramifications for the use of glyphosate-based products like Roundup in New Zealand. Because he set to and did that, and then Fiscal Information Act stuff showed that the EPA and Ministry for Primary Industries staff were editing as well. And they come back and basically say, well, no, we don't think it is the case. But most of their finding, because they chose to discount certain independent peer-reviewed science, the stuff that they found it on mostly, not only, but was on industry-based science. So they say it's a weight of evidence, and that's very, very arguable. I have scientists in New Zealand that totally agree with where I'm coming from and saying that that was a shoddy report, and they were totally wrong to challenge IARC, who they standardly use as a source of their base information around the toxicity of different principal ingredients. So we've got a shambles here. I think the EPA needs to be turned on its head, needs to be investigated thoroughly as to its motivations and its processes.
I'm speaking with Stephen Browning, who is the Green MP in the New Zealand Parliament, who is retiring in a couple of months' time from the stage of politics. A lot of activists understand what you're saying, Stephen, because I'm in a situation where I know of a professional in the Waikato who has told me that farmers can come onto their land, and if they're wanting to put a crop in like potatoes or sweet corn possibly or pumpkin, they can spray this land late in spring so that all the grass is killed off very quickly so that then they can get the new food crop in for the summer. And after 4 days, cows are allowed to come along and eat that dying grass, and those cows are then milked that night, and that goes into New Zealand's milk supply where we get milk, butter, cheese and milk powder from. You have heard of this too?
Yes, and worse than that, some of the baleage, so you've got stuff growing for fodder, not just for grazing off a paddock that's been sprayed, and that's appalling. They do it with sheep and they do it with cattle, but I'm not sure on the rules around milking cows. I've certainly seen beef and I've seen sheep. And I've seen very young sheep too. But the dairy herd will be getting it at least another way through the baleage. So sometimes you see the hay is ready to be picked. In some instances, they are spraying that with Roundup. You won't see it go golden. They'll leave it very few hours, like 48 hours or so, rather than a week. And what it does is it semi-dehydrates it. It still will have the green, might be just starting to turn colour a little. And then that's baled. And it gives them a higher solid mix in that. They reckon it sweetens it. That is also being fed to animals in New Zealand. And we do have an issue with the amount going in there. Now, Fonterra and MPI have done some testing, and they reckon they're not finding glyphosate in dairy products. I have some real questions about their methodology and the independence of testing and so forth. It has been questioned. It's just a very, very difficult thing to test for in dairy products, and there's sure as hell a desire not to be finding it in this country. The reality is, like those European politicians, New Zealanders will have glyphosate in them. Now, scientists that I know are very concerned, not just what's going in the food chain, they're very, very worried about what people are being exposed to in an incremental amount, so a little bit here, a little bit there, by what's going on in streets and parks and the dust exposure to maybe on people's clothing, the pets coming in from out in the street and jumping on the lap or walking across the carpet. But there's low-level continual exposure. The industry says it's all around dose. It's the amount of milligrams per kilo you're getting exposed to and low level. But we know that low level is very important around endocrine disruption. There's very, very big issue with this continual low level exposure. And our EPA chose not to look at any of that. They just want to stay within what they call as best laboratory practice or certain guidelines. Well, unfortunately, those guidelines were set up alongside industry. They aren't the independent precautionary guidelines that New Zealanders deserve and would assume were being operated to.
Yes, well, it's just when the mothers of New Zealand or the mothers of the world realise what they've been feeding their children, not realising what's in the product, we're going to have a woman's rebellion against the industrial society. And this is not fair. This is just blatantly, a psychopathic way of going about life. We've taken so many shortcuts. In the last 30 years or 40 years, I guess, since Thatcherism, Reaganomics and Rogernomics here in this country, it's all been about making a profit, and money has become the god. And community doesn't seem to be factored into this. I mean, goodwill doesn't seem to be a part of the vernacular anymore. We need to be able to find a way back, a way back to simplicity and neighbours working with each other and just sheer honesty. But I'm just shocked at the cavalier attitude of so many...
Well, it's the politics, isn't it? And Auckland City Council is a prize example of where short-term economic expediency meant the rollback of those vast areas that were chemical herbicide-free. So the glyphosate has been rolled back. Some of them had never had it. And past mayor, and now we've got Phil Goff being implicit with it as well, with the spraying of Auckland streets and parks. Now, they're pulling back on this bit here and there, but there's people that have worked on this for, well, it's a generational thing now, but they've worked on it for decades. And Hannah Blackmore, I applaud her for her work, and Dr. Muriel Watts.
Yes.
And Hannah's daughter, Georgina, she's done a whole lot of work too. And for this, that council and its senior staff, who I would love to name, who have been so poor in their approach and their information that they're doing to the councillors and the mayor, Penny Hulse, she's just playing the line. I've met with her. I was meant to meet with Phil Goff, who bailed the night before. They are relying on the EPA and its misinformation to justify rolling out against community preference.
Yes.
This glyphosate-based herbicides, effectively Roundup, but there's other brand names in there throughout. And that's just the stuff that the scientists are saying is a real threat to community health. You'll hear more from me on this one outside this interview, Tim.
Yes, next month there's a big shift happening at the moment in America from the standpoint that Monsanto can't wait to hand over keys to Bayer because they're losing some of the battle in the United States. And Bayer, the Swiss company, is evidently coming in to buy out a particular part of Monsanto. And I don't know why they should buy it out. They should let Monsanto sink because it's going to sink, and Bayer most probably are going to be caught up and sink with it. And
well, they're complicit. Are still going for new technologies all the time, and so they will be seeing... Bayer is a massive pesticides and pharmaceutical industry thing. I've been past it miles and miles or kilometres and kilometres driving along the Autobahn in Germany and seeing this area that's just Bayer of factories and plant. Yes, it's appalling that those big companies are merging. Syngenta's doing it with the major Chinese one. And so the monster carries on, and it's just adapting to commercial realities, I think. But we must beat it, and we must beat it here in New Zealand.
Yeah, so, well, looking back over your 6 years in Parliament, you would have been able to get a real good understanding of so much of how the parliamentary system works or doesn't work. But the other thing is, because I follow you on Facebook, you're out there amongst New Zealanders and you meet some wonderful people out there, and you're on the road all the time, Stefan, and you've been in so many different farms and gardens and met so many quality people. What are some of the highlights that you have found just meeting the good, ordinary, down-to-earth New Zealander?
Yeah, and I have been privileged in the ability to move around more freely than I did when I was less resourced. I'm not doing it quite to the extent, but I'm still trying to get about. Some of the things, I suppose it's easiest to think of the ones that have been more recent. It was great to see the pickup and to actually get Primary Production Select Committee members to the Hawke's Bay to look at organics and showing just how good it can be, and to hear the Select Committee chair understanding it's about the soil and the building up and the health of the soil, and that being the base, healthy soil, healthy food, healthy people, and hearing that repeated even at Select Committee last week. So that sort of stuff is great when you see that progression, because I went there with the idea if I'd move that committee 5% out of however you might measure it towards those more sustainable things, it would be a success. So it was great to hear that. But recently I was down in Christchurch, and my good friend Dr. Matt Morris from Soil and Health down there, but for various other initiatives around the edible Canterbury stuff out of the rebuild. And to be right in there in Peterborough Street in some fantastic community garden type initiatives right in the town where they were go out, not Matt. Matt was with me, and he wasn't running that particular scheme, but it's part of one of the schemes that they do. But here they were cycling with a trailer that goes to the restaurants to pick up the bins of food waste that were coming back in to be composted at this place, and then salad greens and the likes were being produced in the gardens that were being fed by the compost, and then they were being sold to restaurants there. So that local food, the totally local approach to food, and it's way more sustainable than even maybe those big things that we were looking at in the Hawke's Bay. So one level you can get the export part covered by those bigger projects, but what's really core and really warms me are these hands-on projects that people are doing with passion, love, and producing healthy, good food and making that city all the more sustainable. And I know that, and I see them in other parts of the country, other initiatives in a similar way. So that always warms me. The methyl bromide issue, which is the fumigation gas that's ozone depleter and neurotoxin, carcinogenic, that's wafting around ports that fumigate their logs on site under the tarpaulins. You see it in Napier, you see it in Tauranga, you see it in Northport at Marsden Point, less and less at others, thank goodness, due to our campaigning in particular. But I won an environment court case in Tauranga. A decision came through early this year, and that was against a new fumigator to operate on the port of Tauranga, probably the largest user in the world of methyl bromide gas. But I don't know how many people in that area have succumbed to motor neurone disease. But in Nelson, well back in the early 2000s, it was noted that and it's Professor Ian Shaw from Canterbury University, saw the statistical link, maybe not the proof of cause, but the statistical link between methyl bromide fumigation and with the rate of motor neurone disease in that community from men that worked in the area where the fumigations were happening. And there were six widows that formed a group called Campaign Against Toxic Sprays. And there was a good environment court case. That port decided that anything would have to be recaptured that was used there, so the log fumigation stopped and the containers always have recapture. Wellington now does recapture on the wharf. Picton in my local area, we stopped the fumigation by methyl bromide there. Now Tauranga, we won that case. There's still the operator there. I was up there last Friday and we had a tour of the port, and I'm just pushing back on what, you know, just saying you've got to get recapture in this year, not 2020 when the EPA says, and we'll probably roll over to industry to extend it. It needs to happen now because there's people and the ozone layer negatively affected by this stuff. So up there, what's one of the things you're saying, what things warm me, that a group of the community got together following a public meeting we had after the win in the Environment Court, and they are just working so well, so professionally at getting onto that council to make sure that it's making sure the consent conditions are being kept. Now, they're not winning the council, and we're meeting up there with them, that group, and me next Saturday afternoon with some of the council staff. But to see all the local community get in behind, and that's where we work together, I guess, that warms me. But there are really beautiful initiatives out there in agriculture. There's some fantastic dairy farmers that have their much smaller herds, having a wonderful time with their families, having better quality time. The animals are happier, the families are happier, the land is happier, the streams are happier. And I see those. And just seeing that they are being more and more portrayed out there as the way to go gives me heart. Sometimes maybe I see too many negative things, Tim, and I don't get to smell the roses, and that's one of the reasons I'm retiring, at least in part, just so that I can have a better balance, because my work-life balance went to hell way more than it did when I was just in the NGO world.
This is one of the challenges when you are a holistic activist, because you see everything from the standpoint of a geophysiologist. You see the atmosphere, you see the water, you see the soil, you see the oceans, you see everything part, and we're essentially making such a impact on the whole geosphere, all of the web of life. And so, yeah, you're on the front lines and you're just becoming sort of semi-traumatized by it all. And, I mean, I'm in the same game, and we have to be able to laugh because no matter what, we're it's just happening to us, and we have to make sure that we keep in balance. Now, with these gases, these are our logs in New Zealand being sent to China and India. They won't accept them unless we do the gassing, so we're not sending any pests to their countries. This is correct?
Yes, and I've got biosecurity as a portfolio too. I understand their concerns, and I think they're quite justified. Why should they take in some insects any more than we should have fruit fly coming in or myrtle rust or an oyster disease? They're entitled to be sure that the two in particular, but it's up to about four beetles that they don't want there. Our government negotiates for different methods of phytosanitary control, as they call it, to kill those and to ensure that we're not exporting to those countries. China allows a different gas, a phosphine gas, to be used, but it cannot be used on the deck cargo because phosphine takes a long time for fumigation to work. They put the gas into the holds of the ships before the ships go, and then they disperse that out at sea quite a few days later, maybe more than a week. It just takes that much longer. So the deck cargo for China still needs methyl bromide fumigation, which means the gas is dispersed in New Zealand. India doesn't accept phosphine, so whether it's below deck or on deck, it still needs methyl bromide fumigation. Now, industry is looking at another gas, and I can't tell you its name apart from being ADN or some initials like that. It's another big long one. It, phosphine, this other alternative, any of them to work need to be pretty damn toxic. They all need to be recaptured if they're being fumigated here, whether it's in the hold, whether it's on the side of the wharf, if it's a container for something else in a warehouse somewhere. That gas should be being, the remnant gas, I have to say, should be being recaptured of whatever those incredibly heavy-duty neurotoxin, carcinogenic-type gases that they use. And that's what we're pushing for. We're not saying we don't export. We'd rather it value-added so that sometimes as sun-sawn timbers don't have to be fumigated. Some still do, but it's more easily managed probably. And Nelson, of course, has done in a special shed and then has the recapture. But here, if we can find other alternatives rather than these highly toxic gases, we should, and more work needs to be done. But in the very meantime, immediately, we should be bringing in recapture technology. It does exist. The fumigator is trying to find his own system so that...
Very good.
Which is fine, but we should be using the one that's available right now.
Excellent.
And looking after our workers and our communities.
That's good. Now, Stefan, I'm just wanting, in closing now, way back early in 2013, I interviewed you and you were at Parliament and you were talking in Parliament about the GSB and the Regulated Legislation Amendment Bill. And I think that was one of the most powerful statements you ever made, where you implored one of the 61 MPs who had previously supported that legislation to change and vote to allow a full inquiry. That was all. And you'd mentioned a lot of things, how at that particular stage in Wellington, there was the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, was in New Zealand, as well as the Attorney General for Canada, UK, Australia and New Zealand. They were all in New Zealand at that particular time, including a good number of FBI agents as well. And that's something that I think that I'm going to put at the bottom of this broadcast, the URL, the link, so that people can see what you were doing way back to waken people to realise that we have to be participators in our democracy here in this country.
Yeah, so with the Five Eyes partnership that New Zealand is in, those countries that you just listed, it was a bit like the government of the day was giving them a gift with this, showing them, hey, look at this. I could just imagine them strutting in front of these spy chiefs of these countries, and as they had passed legislation to allow absolute intrusion into New Zealanders' communications. And here they were, these people in the country right then when the legislation passed. We heard all about the SAS sort of bill and that, but there was telecommunications interception legislation that was going along parallel to that, that allowed everything from a baby monitor through to any form of telecommunication, electronic communication to be surveilled. And the conditions and times when and that were sloppy as hang. We can assume that this interview is being surveilled. Whether there's somebody actually listening in, because you and I are outspoken on these sorts of things, not necessarily, but picked up, stored in the US or wherever they've got their hardware for it, but it all goes through the NSA, the National Security Agency of the US, through my local Waihopai spy base, or one of the multitude of other bases around the world that make that a very effective interception grid. And so that level of interception and invasion of privacy, and here they were passing the legislation, nicely managing it so that it would happen while the people that they would try and impress. It's a strange, strange world, and it makes you wonder, who are the puppet string pullers there? Is it bureaucrats gone mad? Is it more contrived than that with the industries? We know that our GCSB spied on competitors when we were trying to get our place, Tim Grosser, and they were actively spying on competitor countries and other ones to see what they were doing and passing that on. It's nothing about our internal security. It's all about economics and establishment and maintaining the status quo. So we know it's being misused. It'll be being misused against those that care about democracy, that care about our environment, that care about social justice.
Yeah. Well, look, I want to say, Stephen, thank you very much, very much for just laying it all out. And I just trust that when you have your holiday at the end of this year away from Parliament, you'll be able to find something that you really enjoy and get heaps of applause from so many people who realise what you've done to make this country a better country and this world a better world.
Yeah, well, thanks very much, Tim. You'll probably see me again. It's hard to give up these things and walk away from them, but I definitely intend to have a little bit of a break at least, and then smell the roses a bit, and hopefully some lovely New Zealand plants that aren't skittled by myrtle rust. And
yes.
But to enjoy seeing my kids and my grandkids as well, and my loved ones, and my lovely good friends. So we'll do that, and I'll just hit the refresh button after a bit of a break.
Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. So thank you again. That was Stephen Browning, the retiring New Zealand Green member for Parliament after 6 years of service to the New Zealand public. You can listen to Green Planet FM on planetaudio.org.nz at 8 a.m. every Thursday, wherever you are on our planet, and have a complete live stream. And you can then also listen to it for the next 7 days by going to planetaudio.org.nz, English, Green, then Green Planet FM. Then iPod stream can be obtained 8 hours after broadcasting on greenplanetfm.com, which has a huge database of interviews, close on 400 now in the archive. And you can also subscribe to itunes.com or listen to iHeartRadio. You can follow Green Planet FM on Facebook at facebook.com/greenplanetfm and twitter.com/greenplanetfm. This is Tim Lynch, in the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. I look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere ura. That was a repeat program. I sincerely trust that you derived some benefit from it.